This is the third talk given by Harry Ring in the history of American Trotskyism.
The first session today is the...
I'll assume that most of you were here yesterday and won't attempt to recapitulate the ground we went over then. In waging the political fight with the opposition in the Socialist Workers' Party in 1940, the opposition led by Shachtman, Burnham, and Ahern, Trotsky characterized this grouping as a petty bourgeois opposition, and in addition characterized it as a politically unprincipled combination. That characterization as an unprincipled combination was based on the fact that there were essentially three different politically different components within this common political faction that had been organized within the SWP. The one tendency within the faction was represented by Burnham, the second by Shachtman, and the third tendency by Ahern. I indicated yesterday some of the political differences that existed between them. Burnham had a fully thought out point of view, which he elaborated in the course of the fight, namely that Marxism is an invalid scientific method, that the Soviet Union was not a worker state, but a bureaucratic collective state, that it was an imperialist state that should be imposed as well as capitalist imperialist states. Martin Ahern took the position that the traditional Trotskyist analysis of the Soviet Union as a degenerated worker state was a correct analysis. He supported Marx's theory, considered dialectical materialism to be a valid scientific philosophical method. He said that he agreed with Burnham and with Shachtman on the question of the invasion of Poland and Finland by the Soviet Union, that what was involved there was not a clash between a worker state but an imperialism, but an act of aggression, a reactionary action by the Soviet bureaucracy that could not and should not be defended. More important, he said, he was in agreement with Shachtman and with Burnham on the question of the bureaucratization, as he saw it, of the regime in the SWP. Shachtman took a middle ground between Burnham and Ahern. He too, more or less, remained committed to the Trotskyist definition of the character of the Soviet state, but tended in the course of the discussion to defend that less and less. By the Soviet Union could not be defended by the Socialist Workers' Party, but attempted to avoid the full conclusions that Burnham drew in regard to the class character of the Soviet Union. And he agreed with Burnham and with Ahern that the alleged bureaucratic character of the regime in the Socialist Workers' Party was a decisive issue that gave the caucus, the faction that they had organized, a legitimate and principled basis for existence as a united caucus. On the question of Burnham's rejection of the Marxist method, of the dialectical method, Shachtman took a completely cavalier attitude, attempted to turn the matter into a joke. I recall that in his presentation his final presentation is the debate with Cannon at the split convention in 1940. Shachtman made the point, yes, it is true that eventually Burnham's rejection of the Marxist dialectical method will lead him away from the socialist movement. But then it is also true that eventually we will have socialism, so what difference does it make? That was Shachtman's contribution to the philosophical discussion. There have been other similar blocks within our movement, which we have characterized as unprincipled political combinations. For example, when we discuss later today, during the week, the fight with the Cochrane faction, you'll find there too that the minority was characterized as an unprincipled combination, that the two principal leaders of it, Cochrane and George Clark, had basically divergent views on several of the key questions that were in dispute. If you were to take them seriously enough, you could have characterized the Wolferth-Robertson group as an unprincipled combination in its latter stage. It tends to dignify it a bit, I think. But to the degree that I could follow their politics, and I literally did have difficulty in ascertaining what their political positions were on given questions, it did appear that they did have differing and conflicting views within their factions on such questions as the class character of the Soviet state, the class character of the Cuban state, and so on. They had within their tendency at that time a group in Detroit, I recall, that supported the position that the Soviet Union and presumably Cuba was state capitalist. And so there, too, you had the same thing. Now, this is a very important political question and one that the Marxist movement has confronted throughout its history, this development, this phenomena of what we characterize as an unprincipled bloc or combination. That is a combination where people agree to put aside basic political differences that exist between them in order to wage a particular common political struggle against a common political opponent. Now, this is not a simple question and not subject to easy, specific definition. Invariably, it comes down to examining each particular case and then examining it, because there are not only unprincipled combinations and unprincipled blocks, but there are also principled ones as well. So in each given case where there is a combination of forces with differing political views or divergent views, it's a matter of determining whether or not there is, from the viewpoint of Marxist principle, a permissible and legitimate basis for the bloc, or whether there is not. Obviously, if a political bloc is an unprincipled one, it creates many political difficulties. For example, this bloc at the beginning of the fight in 1940 had close to a majority, and it was not excluded that they might have won a majority of the Socialist Workers' Party and won the leadership of the Socialist Workers' Party. They would then have been confronted with a very interesting, rather complex political question. That is, which program would become the program of the Socialist Workers' Party? That is, the program of Ahern, the program of Shachtman, or the program of Burnham. Further, it's been a historical observation that such combinations or blocks are rarely durable and are fairly easily and quickly broken as a result of the political contradictions that are inherent in them, that are lodged within them. The most politically costly aspect of such unprincipled combinations, where each section of the combination has the idea invariably that they are using the other sectors of the block, that they are deriving a particular political benefit at the expense of the other, that the contradiction, so to speak, is with the other group or groups within the block, that what happens inevitably is that that sector of the block, if there is one, which does have a clearly thought out political line, eventually emerges as the decisive sector of the block. And if the block does continue for any period of time, the politics of the tendency within the block that does have a thought out political viewpoint eventually comes to prevail within the block, and its politics become the politics of the entire block. And the Shachtman-Burnham-Ahern block was a classic example and verification of this political fact of life. The only one in the block that had a really clearly thought out political point of view and a basic conception was Burnham and the people around him. Shachtman and Ahern attempted to brush aside and to sweep under the rug the very important political differences that they had at the outset of the fight with Burnham, and sought to subordinate them to what they saw that they had in common with him, namely to break away from the conception of the unconditional defense of the Soviet Union and to wage a struggle against what they saw as a bureaucratic regime within the Socialist Workers' Party. Within a matter of a year, by the time the Workers' Party, the split-off group from the Socialist Workers' Party, was established, the basic political views of Burnham, at least on the Russian question, came to be the views of the entire bloc. Step by step in the process of political development, the Ahernites and the Shachtmanites in the bloc found themselves simply being dragged along and becoming more and more Burnhamites rather than Shachtmanites or Ahernites. The writings of Cannon, again, are extremely valuable in studying this entire question of political blocks. As I indicated, there are cases where a political bloc is an entirely justifiable and necessary thing. There are political blocs that exist between political movements. For example, we have entered into many political blocs in the mass movement, in the trade union movement, in the anti-war movement, in the women's liberation movement, and almost all of the outside movements that our party has functioned in. We have entered into blocks of one degree or another, one extent or another, with other differing and opponent political forces, or with forces, while we have a friendly attitude to, we have political differences with. And within the history of the movement, both within the Socialist Workers' Party and previously to that within the Communist Party, many blocs existed, both here in this country on an international scale, in the international left opposition and the struggle against the rise of Stalinism, in the left opposition that existed in the Soviet Union, where Trotsky made a whole series of blocs with other forces within the Communist Party of the Soviet Union against the Stalin regime. So it becomes a concrete question, and what has to be examined is what is the character of a given bloc, what is the political physiognomy of it, what are the relationships within the political bloc. What is the actual numerical and political relationship of forces? What is the specific weight of the different tendencies within it? And the decisive question, of course, against whom is the political bloc aimed? In other words, what is the purpose and the aim of the political bloc? Trotsky put it in its most general and abstract form when he said, the scope of permissible differences within a bloc is determined by the character of the adversary. Now, that's a very broad and general statement, but it's a basic guiding line. For example, it's a violation of Marxist principle to have any kind of a political bloc with the capitalist class. But against nature, let us say, in the case of an earthquake, if I may mention the word, I can easily see where you might have one or another kind of bloc, even with the capitalist class, in coping with the problems resulting from this adversary. That's a rather extreme example to indicate the point. There is this whole history, which is extremely rich and worth studying, of the various blocs made by Trotsky and the left opposition with other opposition forces within the Soviet Communist Party. I would not attempt to try to go into them here, but to indicate to you that they're all available, a history of that in Trotsky's writing, and again, very much worth studying. Another extremely valuable source of information on this question is in Jim Cannon's book, The First 10 Years of American Communism, where he describes a whole series of blocs which the group in the Cannon faction, the Cannon-Foster faction, engaged in the various struggles within the Communist Party, in the struggle to establish a legal Communist Party as opposed to the ultra-lefts who insisted that it had to be an underground party as a matter of principle, on the trade union question, and on the whole series of questions which divided the Communist Party. Cannon entered into blocs with other tendencies, with Lovestone, with Barry Forrester, with various other forces, on the basis of particular issues that they were in agreement on, and which gives you that, I think, is in at least in American terms, the most concrete description of the conception of political blocs and what are justified and principled ones and what are unprincipled blocs. We have seen with the coexistence of various tendencies in our movement, in the Socialist Workers' Party, what could be described in a sense as blocs. For example, there was the group led by J.R. Johnson, the pen name for C.L.R. James. They had originally been a part of the Schachtman group in 1940, the Schachtman-Burnham group. They left with them, formed the Workers' Party with them, became a separate tendency within the Workers' Party. Johnson developed the theory of state that the Soviet Union was state capitalist. At the same time as the Workers' Party continued to move steadily to the right, the Johnson tendency balked at that rightward development, found themselves in greater and greater disagreement with this rightward drift, and finally, in one point, I believe in 1948 or 49, broke with the Workers' Party and rejoined the Socialist Workers' Party as a group, because they said that while they disagreed with us on the Russian question, they were in agreement with us on the perspectives for the American Revolution, that they were in agreement with the political resolution adopted by the 1946 convention of the Socialist Workers' Party, a basic document of our movement, the thesis on the coming American Revolution. And on that basis, they were accepted back into membership in the Socialist Workers' Party. They existed as a tendency within our movement for a couple of years. And you could say that in that sense that what existed then was a block between our movement and the Johnson tendency. The Marcy tendency, the people who later broke from our movement and emerged as the Workers' World Party and Youth Against War and Fascism, existed as a tendency within our movement for a period of 3, 4, 5 years, perhaps. And at one point, at the early stage of the fight with Cochran, they were in a bloc with the Cochranites. At a later stage, they found that their agreement with us was greater than their agreement with the Cochranites. They broke their bloc with Cochran and essentially established a bloc with the majority against Cochran. Similarly, the Johnson group that I mentioned, the state capitalist group, left our movement again in 1950, but a small section of their group decided to remain in the party, principally a group in Detroit led by a man by the name of Art Fox. And when the fight broke out with the Cochran tendency, the group led by Fox was in agreement with the majority, and we entered into a bloc with them. Because of their position on the Russian question, namely that Soviet Union was state capitalist, we made a decision not to permit them to join the majority caucus, because the majority caucus was organized on the basis of a political program, and we felt that their views were in conflict with that, and yet we were in agreement on a whole number of questions. So you can say that, in effect, we had a bloc with them. Similarly, when the group led by Tim Wolforth and Robertson broke with the Shackmanites in the late 50s and rejoined our movement and helped to organize the Young Socialist Alliance, we had many basic political differences with them. Yet we were in agreement with them on a whole number of questions, and the relationship that was established could, again, in essence, be characterized or described as a political bloc, and in my opinion, a completely justified and principled one. In general, I think you can say that a bloc can be regarded as unprincipled. First of all, when you are blocking with someone with whom you have greater disagreements politically than the one that you are blocking against. Let us say, for example, there are two groups within the Socialist Workers' Party that decides that the political leadership of the party is organizationally inadequate. It's bureaucratic, it's incompetent, it's cliquist, whatever it may be. And let us say that of the two groupings that have this viewpoint about the leadership of the party, one grouping is in political agreement with the leadership of the party, even though they may have organizational disagreements with them, and the other group has basic political disagreements with the leadership of the party. And in addition to a group disagreeing with them on basic political questions, also has organizational criticisms, grievances, and so on. If for the sake of combating what they see as defects in the political regime of the party, the political leadership of the party, they were to enter into a united caucus and, so to speak, put aside or attempt to conceal or bury the political disagreements that exist between them for the sake of their common struggle on what is essentially a lesser question, even though it's an important question, that would be an example of an unprincipled bloc. Essentially, that was the kind of a bloc that Ahern was involved in. He was in political agreement with the majority, and yet he put aside that political agreement on fundamental political issues like the question of Marxist theory, the class character of the Soviet Union, for the sake of blocking with people to wage a war against what he saw as a bureaucratic regime in the party. Now, where you find unprincipled blocks in combination in the Marxist movement, invariably the principal justification for such a block is precisely this question of a struggle against the regime. That what is important is that there is a bureaucratic regime in the party, and what does it matter if comrades A and B disagree on basic issues of political principle? They're both agreed that the regime is bureaucratic, that it's ineffectual, and therefore that justifies them organizing together for the sake of doing something about correcting the regime in the party. This question of the struggle against the party regime has been a central focus of virtually every faction that has existed within the SWP, every opposition faction. About the only one that I can think of that was an exception was the group led by Sam Morrissey, which later formed the Workers' World Party. I will say that for them, that as far as I can recall, except for a few squabbles at the very end, they never raised the so-called organization question, but fought exclusively on the political issues on which they were in disagreement with the party. I suspect that it was because by this time they were so far removed from the present planet that they weren't particularly interested in such small questions as the character of the party regime. But in any event, they are the one exception that my memory at least serves as not being involved in this. In the early years of our movement, if you can find among the archives some of the early internal bulletins, you'll find there were a whole series of factional struggles. This was before the 1939 fight, in the period from 1930-31 through 33. At one or another time, Shachtman was waging a struggle against the Cannon regime. Ahern was waging a struggle, sometimes Shachtman and Ahern in combination, and so on. And of course, it was a central aspect of the 1939-40 fight, and was spelled out in the principal, and as far as I know, the sole programmatic document of the minority faction, of the Burnham faction. And that was the document, The War and Bureaucratic Conservatism. As far as I can recall, that was the only political document signed by all of the leaders of the minority faction. In the fight that followed after that, during the Second World War and at the close of the Second World War, with the Morrow-Goldman faction, here too, the struggle against bureaucratism as they saw it in the party regime was a central issue. It began with small questions there, as most of these fights do. The opening gun in that fight, as I recall, was their criticism of an article that Joe Hansen wrote at the time that the Minneapolis defendants went to prison, and Joe wrote a feature article for the Militant, I think, about Jim Cannon as he was leaving for prison, and tried to depict some of Jim's very warm personal qualities and his qualities as a human being, as well as a political leader. And this article surprisingly came under very sharp political attack as an example of the cult of the individual within our movement, reminiscent of the Stalinist cult of the individual. And then other issues began to develop, criticism by Goldman and Morrow and others associated with them, until finally it developed into a whole thesis that the party leadership had in fact become Stalinist and were nothing but a gang of Stalinist bureaucrats, essentially the same thesis made by the Burnham-Shachtman opposition in 1940. Similarly, with the Cochrane fight, there too a major justification for what was, again, an unprincipled combination was a struggle against what they characterize as also a bureaucratically conservatized regime. their principal political document was entitled The Roots of the Party Crisis. And again, it was not so much a political analysis of the political program of the leadership as it was a recitation of a series of grievances and accusations of bureaucratic practices by the party leadership. The Wolfert and Robertson group also, before they left the party, made their contribution to the struggle against bureaucratism in the SWP and the struggle against the Cannon regime. This has gone on for so long in our movement and has been such a consistent feature of every significant opposition faction that is developed within our movement that I know when I was a kid, people used to say, well, you know, with all that smoke, maybe there is some fire. I mean, you know, I don't see it myself. The party seems to me to have a pretty democratic structure, and the leadership seems quite democratic. But if there are always so many people, and over the years there have been so many people who complain so bitterly about the Cannon regime and the bureaucratic leadership of the party, maybe they're exaggerating, and maybe they're inventing a bit, but, you know, there may be something to it. And you have to stop then and think out the question. Trotsky made the comment in the course of the 1940 discussion. He said, very often the conviction that the party regime is bureaucratic develops within a political minority in the party that finds it difficult to gain any significant number of adherents for its political viewpoint, is unable to gain significant political ground in the party to make headway for its ideas and for its attempt to win leadership within the party. And he says, very often people tend to assume that if they can't win adherence to their viewpoint within the party, that it's not possibly because there may be something defective in their viewpoint, but because there must be some bureaucrats standing in the way of people being persuaded and won to their point of view and to their leadership. Invariably, however, where these charges of bureaucratism are made, as they were made in 1940 with such extreme vigor, and where it, at the beginning of the fight, was a greater issue in so far as the minority was concerned than the Russian question even, such charges reflect deeper political differences, and almost invariably, where they do not, they lay the ground for creating them. There have been people in our movement, and Ahern again was the classic example of it, who had no particular political disagreements of any consequential nature with the party leadership, but always remained in opposition to the party leadership, always considered themselves in the posture of defending the democratic rights of the party membership against the bureaucrats in the leadership of the party. And invariably, the history of the movement has demonstrated where such groupings as the Ahernites existed, whose sole purpose was the struggle against bureaucracy, that such groups had to accept one or another kind of political disagreement in order to justify their existence as a group. Because in our movement, the Trotskyist movement and the Marxist movement, the concept of the primacy of political principles is so deeply ingrained within the party membership that a grouping cannot expect to make any headway within the party unless it can demonstrate to the party membership that it has a distinctive political point of view that warrants consideration by the membership. The membership of our party, and incidentally, when I say the party, I'm using that as shorthand for the party and the YSA as well. The membership of our movement are trained to estimate groupings inside and outside the party by their political ideas. Organizational issues are extremely important to us, but they're secondary to political principles and have meaning only to the degree that they are related to political principles. And that's why a group which simply exists around the issue of organizational grievances inevitably finds itself compelled to find some political issue to justify its existence if it wishes to gain any kind of a serious hearing from the party membership. There is a reason, I think, however, why people who are in political disagreement with the views of the party, or simply in the process of beginning to develop such disagreements, have doubts, questions, reservations about the party program or one or another aspect of it, begin to find themselves increasingly dissatisfied with the way that the party functions and with what they see as the character of the party regime, and begin to see what they regard as bureaucratic tendencies and practices within the party. Our party, as a party, its leadership, its established, elected, selected, democratically selected leadership, the whole tradition of our movement, its politics, its history, its method of functioning, all of this has a tremendous meaning for those who are in agreement with and committed to the program of the party, because an essential aspect of that political agreement is a political understanding that the socialist program can be realized only if a Marxist-Leninist party is successfully built into a mass party. So those who are in agreement with the basic program and perspective of the party take the party itself and its leadership extremely seriously and have a tremendous respect for it. Not a blind, unthinking, uncritical one, but a serious and a basic political respect for the party and its leadership. But, I say, if individuals or groups are in the process of developing differences with questions, doubts, reservations about the program and the perspective of the party, then they cannot help but begin to see the party and its leadership in a somewhat different light. The same political regime in a party can look very different to different people because of differing political views. Take smaller examples. Let us say the party decides to embark on an election campaign. It requires a good deal of work, effort, sacrifice for the party membership. Some states it requires tremendous effort going out collecting the petitions necessary to get out, get the party on the ballot. In a state like Michigan, they used to have to go through the whole state in the middle of the winter, the ice and snow and the witch hunting period. In New York, you have to go through every single one of the 62 counties, including upstate rural areas where you have to go from farmhouse to farmhouse. An extremely arduous task, and the party has to be mobilized on a full scale in order to carry through such a project, to get on the ballot in such states. Well, if you're in political agreement with the need for and the value of such an election campaign, you respond to the party's call and the party's mobilization. You say, fine, great. If you think the Militant is really a great newspaper, and you think that it should be read as widely as possible, and the party decides to have a circulation campaign, and it means getting out every Sunday or two nights a week selling the paper, and the party leadership insists that everybody participates, if you are in agreement with the objective of that campaign, you say, fine, great, right on, let's go. But if you are beginning to feel, let us say, that election campaigns don't really accomplish that much for the party, or if you are beginning to feel that the militant really isn't all that great, and that selling it to wide numbers of people really doesn't have that much of a political effect, and you find the party leadership insisting that you get out and do the work of the petitioning of getting the party on the ballot, insisting that you get out and participate in the subscription campaign that's been decided on by the party membership, if you don't feel that that's as worthwhile as other people, you can begin to have a different attitude toward the party leadership, which is calling upon you to do this. In one case, if you're in agreement, you can say, that's, well, we've got a good, aggressive party leadership that sees what has to be done, gets out and mobilizes the membership, motivates them, and puts the pressure on and gets everyone out to do it. But if you don't agree with it, or you're starting to have some questions, you probably say, those bureaucratic sons of bitches, here they are again demanding we do this, that, or the other thing. So I use that as a rather homely example, if that's the word, to suggest the thought process which is very often involved, as it has been my observation and experience, of those who begin to see a bureaucratic development, which is what I will simply state as a matter of fact, and which, if you haven't made up your own mind about, you will have to think out and study out, is actually the most democratic political organization probably in the history of humankind. The organization question, so-called, that is the struggle against a bureaucratic regime, is also a favored focal point of unprincipled combinations. That is where you have a group like the Burnham-Shachtman-Ahern group, where it's very difficult for them to have a discussion within the party as a whole on issues on which they're in disagreement themselves. It's much more effective to have a discussion on the issue in the party and to focus on the issue on which they are in agreement, that is, the bureaucratic regime in the party. Also, it's been the experience of such groupings that very often this can be a handy vote getter, that you can pick up votes and supports from all kinds of people who may not be particularly interested in or sympathetic to the particular viewpoint which actually motivates your formation. There are always, as I said, people of a cliquist inclination within the revolutionary socialist movement. It's one of the reflections of our society that can never be totally eliminated or isolated. As the years have gone by, we have had far less of it in our movement than we had in the early days because of the whole experience, educational process, the whole tradition that has been established within the movement. But to one extent or another, it always exists in the party, and people of a cliquist inclination are ready material for a grouping that wants to wage a struggle against a bureaucratic regime, whether it be on a local or on a national scale. There are also people within the movement invariably who are classified as professional rank and filers. This too is a reflection of what sometimes is a healthy sentiment in the world in general. That is just a generalized mistrust and suspicion of leadership. Anyone who's had experience in the trade union movement knows that there is every justification for giving the benefit of the doubt to someone who accuses the leadership of one or another crime. And in most bourgeois organizations, such criticism, such a critical view, putting a question mark over the leadership, feeling the need to constantly watch the leadership, is an understandable thing. And very often that's brought into the party. That is, you'll find individuals who, on principle, so to speak, keep a question mark over the leadership. Now, of course, leadership should never be accepted blindly, uncritically, unquestioningly. But there is a difference between an independent, critical attitude toward all political questions, including the character and performance of a political regime, and that of the professional rank and file, filer who expresses the concept that leadership in and of itself is essentially corruptible, if not already corrupt. There are the misguided Democrats, again, a reflection of our society. In a society where there is so much injustice, people of a rebellious nature almost instinctively respond sympathetically to the underdog, to the minority that's standing up against a big, powerful force. And inevitably, when a fight erupts in the party, and what looks like a small minority is waging a struggle against the whole leadership of the party, there are people who will say, well, I don't know whether they're right or not, but Jesus Christ, they're the underdogs, et cetera, and so on. And there are always, of course, necessarily, and it's a good thing, new and inexperienced people in the movement. And part of the process of education is to simply not only learn the abstract political concepts, but to learn the meaning of Marxist politics in the concrete, including the meaning of the relationship between organizational issues and political issues. And very often, people who are first becoming familiar with these things can be easily misled, and the history of these various factional struggles in the party, where the organizational issue was put to the fore in the initial stage of the fight, always found that many new and inexperienced people were affected by this and either permanently or for a period of time were persuaded by these so-called organizational grievances. Another aspect of factional struggle within the political movement, which was illustrated in its most classical form in the 1940 fight, but in other fights as well, is that such political struggles rarely begin with the basic issues that are in dispute. Very often, either these basic issues are concealed, as they were at first by Burnham, or later by Clark and Cochrane, or they are simply not perceived, and very often they are a process which actually develops and is not, so to speak, a preconceived plan, that is, of having a major disagreement, but simply starting out by presenting it in a small way. That happens, but very often a series of small disagreements can, not necessarily do, but can develop into basic political disagreements. Trotsky observed that every serious discussion develops from the particular and even the accidental to the general and the fundamental. And almost invariably, when you study the history of faction fights, you'll find that that is the case. Now, what that means for political people is that you have to take an extremely serious attitude toward political differences within the movement. A serious attitude, it means precisely that. It does not mean lacking a sense of proportion. It means an objective attitude. It means understanding that it's a mistake to minimize or to gloss over political differences, and that it's equally mistaken to exaggerate them, to jump to hasty conclusions as to the fundamental meaning of such disagreements. But because political disagreements all have merit in and of themselves, and because experience has shown us that often they can develop into more significant political disputes. They have to be taken seriously and weighed in a serious, open-minded, critical, and objective way. The 1940 fight actually began in 1937, 38, 39 with a series of complaints and grievances about the party regime. It first expressed itself, manifested itself in the 1939 convention of the party. I recall it in one sense quite vividly. It was the first convention that I was a delegate to, and I came back to my branch and was very mortified to have to report to the branch that some kind of a big fight had taken place there between Cannon and Shachtman, two principal leaders of the party, and that as a delegate I didn't understand what the hell they were fighting about, and that when it came to a vote, I had to abstain on the vote. And I felt that I had failed in my duty to the branch that had set me as a delegate to that convention. The fight was around a proposal by Shachtman that in addition to the post of national secretary of the party, that the post be created of organizational secretary, and that in addition to the post of organizational secretary, there be an organizational department established. It seemed like a rather practical political proposal. And yet Cannon, whom I already respected as a very serious political leader of our movement, very vigorously and very vehemently opposed the proposal, along with a majority of the delegates. And after some extensive and heated discussion, which I say I did not follow at all, the proposal was defeated. What it was, it became apparent within a few months, was that Shachtman had already begun to develop the viewpoint that the party leadership, particularly the predominant influence of Cannon, was having a negative effect on the party, that it was developing in a bureaucratic direction. But rather than simply stating that, which you could at least understand and attempt to estimate, he instead sought to cope with the problem with an organizational maneuver. That is, without laying his cards on the table and saying, I think this Cannon is a bureaucratic son of a bitch and we got to cut down his power, and the way to do it is by an organizational device that will provide for some sharing of the power that he holds as national secretary, and therefore I propose that we have an organizational secretary as well as a national secretary. Instead of that, he went through a lot of incomprehensible historical analogies, as I recall, which sounded very impressive, but which I didn't quite see the point to, about Lenin and Sverdlov, and how they had done things in the old Bolshevik party and so on, and simply concealed what, in other words, he had a lot of good reasons, but he didn't give his real reason. And as a result, the whole thing was at that point incomprehensible. Then again, in my own experience, I recall how troubled I was. The organizer of the Newark branch at that time, where I was a member, new young member, was a man by the name of Ernest McKinney. He was one of the first black people in the leadership of our movement, a very able man. I had an enormous respect for him, learned a great deal from him. Well, he began coming back from New York from political committee meetings and began to confide in me and to others some of the terrible things that were going on in the national office of the party and within the political committee of the party, and how a clique seemed to be developing in the party leadership. And Cannon seemed to be developing a whole group of what he called hand-raisers around them. And I remember him telling me one story, which really troubled me very greatly, about a meeting of the political committee where Shachtman had made a proposal, and three or four people spoke in support of Shachtman's proposal. Then Cannon spoke against Shackman's proposal, and they put it to a vote, and the people who had previously spoken in support of Shackman's proposal voted with Cannon, which obviously is not the way things are done in a principled political party like ours. And there was a whole series of such stories. I had no way of checking or verifying these things or the other people he was telling them to, and it was really rather upsetting to hear this from a respected leader, party organizer, man who had had experience, a record in the mass movement, and so on. There was a city convention in New York, I remember, and we got a report on that. And there was a big struggle in 1939 about the demand that the party put out more penny pamphlets, that the party wasn't really making the headway it should, and the reason it wasn't putting out enough popular pamphlets. Then an expensive pamphlet was a dime pamphlet. The average pamphlet was a nickel. And there was this proposal for penny pamphlets, that if we put out a whole series of penny pamphlets on specific issues, that this would make a qualitative difference in the movement. Well, again, it was, you know, a practical question. You could have an opinion on it, pro or con, but what was curious about it was the tremendous heat that this debate engendered within the New York local of the party. The penny pamphlet struggle, it struck me as a rather curious issue. Well, all of these things kept building and accumulating, all of these horror stories about the regime, the Cannon regime, vicious personal gossip about personal habits of Cannon, others, all of this combined. And then finally, it was generalized in this document, which is included in the Struggle for a Proletarian Party, I believe, yes, the War and Bureaucratic Conservatism. And where they finally sought to give a political motivation and explanation for what they now characterized as a bureaucratic regime in the party. That is, they explained that a whole series of extremely complex and unanticipated events had taken place in the world, the Polish events, the Finnish events, the Stalin-Hitler Pact, etc., and so on, that the party leadership under Cannon had proven itself politically incapable of responding to these events, to making an adequate political analysis of them, to offer the party a correct political perspective and strategy for responding to these events. And because they were incapable of politically coping with the new developments in the world, that they were using bureaucratic methods to deal with those, to suppress those who were trying to think out and provide meaningful answers to the party. And they characterized it as bureaucratic conservative because they said the inability of the party leadership, principally of what they described as the Cannon clique, to respond to these events was a political conservatism, that the party leadership was rooted in certain past conceptions, that they had learned these conceptions by rote, that they were not capable of adding to and elaborating to the program as new events demanded. The refusal of the party leadership, of the central core of the party leadership, what they call the Cannon regime or the Cannon clique, their refusal to panic and to submit to the petty bourgeois pressure that was sweeping the radical movement at that time. Their insistence on standing fast on our program and saying, take it easy, it's still a good program, something to hold on to. We haven't figured out all of the answers to these new events. That's true, and we're going to have to do that. But meanwhile, we stand by our established program. We haven't seen anything occur yet in the world, which means that we should abandon that program. This revolutionary insistence on standing by our program in the face of pressure, of heavy social pressure, was seen by those who were succumbing to that pressure as conservatism. Initially, It was a question of bad methods, their charges, not a political issue. When they were talking about the various things that were happening at the beginning of the fight, that Cannon was what they called a Tammany-type politician, a Tammany Hall-type politician. It wasn't that he had wrong ideas or incorrect political ideas, but his problem was he wasn't interested in ideas, that all he was interested in was organizational problems and organizational questions. And when they talked about the bureaucratic Cannon regime, and people pointed out that they had a majority on the political committee, and that they had the editorship of the paper and of the magazine and so on, they said, well, yeah, that only proves Cannon isn't interested in political ideas. He'll let anybody do the political work as long as he has organizational control. He's a Tammany politician, and he's built the Tammany machine. Well, it became apparent that Cannon did have some political ideas which they happened to be in very fundamental political disagreement. And the big lesson that was to be learned from that whole dispute, and is to be learned from a study of the writings of that dispute, is that organizational methods cannot be separated from political principles and political program, and cannot be correctly and meaningfully assessed, isolated from, and separated from the political principles to which they are related. Stalinism uses bad methods. Stalinism is a conservative force. But as I indicated yesterday, it is extremely dangerous politically not to recognize and understand that the conservatism of the Communist Party, of the Kremlin bureaucracy, that the bad methods, the bureaucratic methods, cannot be understood in isolation from their politics, but are a reflection and an expression and a concretization and a method of carrying out their counter-revolutionary politics, and that the two are inseparably intertwined. Now, there is this one other aspect. A party or a party leadership can have a basically correct political program, but it can be conservative. That is, conservative not in the sense of being right-wing, but conservative in the sense of having a certain routinist approach to politics, of a tendency to judging new phenomena simply on the basis of past phenomena, of not having the capacity to analyze and seek to understand new developments and how the party can and must relate to those new developments. That is a genuine question and something that the party on more than one occasion has been guilty of. We have reacted in a conservative way to new developments, did not respond to them as quickly and effectively as we might have. As I tried to indicate yesterday in an extremely skimpy overview of party history, I think in the main we have passed the test. Pardon me, could I trouble someone for some water? I'm about to give out up here. Do you mind waiting just a minute? I know what's going to happen if I try to keep on talking. I'm just going to give out altogether. Yeah.
Slightly used.
Slightly used?
No, germ.
It's broken in. It's probably that awful whiskey that was being served last night. All that cigarette smoke. I think Comrade Cannon formulated the question very well in attempting to assess the criteria to be used in attempting to assess whether or not a party or a party leadership or regime is conservative. And that's his classic formulation, which has been repeated many times in the struggle for a proletarian party, where he said, the essence of politics is to understand the realities of a given situation, to know what is possible and what is excluded, above all, to know what to do next and to do it. I can't think of anyone who has ever put it better. It's a very general formulation, but again, if you stop and think back and review and study the history and the development of our party, the measure of its success, I think, has been that at each crucial stage, say barring lesser cases where we did not succeed, but at each significant political stage, our party was able to understand what the reality of a given situation is, to know what is possible and what is excluded. That is, how we can use our tiny resources to the most effect, where we have to pick and choose between a number of varying and different opportunities for the movement, where a particular opportunity exists to accomplish our general aim, and to have the capacity to go ahead and to do it. A final word on this charge that Jim Cannon had a bureaucratic clique surrounding him, and through that clique maintained a bureaucratic control of the party. The history of the movement, I repeat, demonstrates that that's without foundation, that charge. But like every political falsehood, there is a certain aspect of it that is not unrelated to reality. In the period when you had Cannon, Shachtman, Ahern, Burnham in the party leadership, in the period before the faction fight even, and then afterward, there were always people in the party who regarded themselves as Cannonites and who would say, I am a Cannonite. That did not mean, for the most part, people who considered themselves part of a Cannon circle or a Cannon clique, but people who recognized and understood that among the various party leaders at that time, that there were, in fact, differing conceptions of how to build the organization, different approaches to the political problems of how to build the movement. And it was apparent simply, I can recall, for example, the first time I heard Shachtman speak and the first time I heard Cannon speak. Both of them were extremely gifted orators. Shachtman was a very brilliant speaker, a very witty speaker. It was better than going to any show to hear one of Shachtman's speeches. He was a tremendously erudite and extremely, he had a rapier-like wit, and it was really an experience to hear one of his speeches before he moved way over to the right. And I remember the first time I heard him and how impressed I was. And then I remember shortly after that hearing Cannon. And even though his oratory was of an entirely different character, it struck me as more powerful. And the reason that it did was not on the basis of technical considerations, but of conveying a sense of a deeper understanding of revolutionary ideas and of a deeper understanding of how to convey those ideas in a meaningful and a living way to broader sections of the population. And in that sense, just on the basis of hearing those two speeches, I began to consider myself a Cannonite, as against a lot of young people in the party who considered themselves, so to speak, Shachtman fans. Now, I'm presenting this in a personal, subjective way. that's subject to oversimplification and to misunderstanding, and I trust that you will understand the sense in which I am making the point. But it went deeper than that. There were many people in the party who realized that within what was actually a, what's the opposite of homogeneous, a heterogeneous party leadership at the time, that the party leader who had the most to contribute in terms of a conception of how to build the movement was Cannon, and that he represented the best of the Leninist tradition within our movement. And there were many people who considered themselves conscious supporters of Cannon in that sense. Now, that did not mean, and I'm talking about people in the leading cadres of the party at the time. Now, that did not mean that there were a clique, a closed circle of friends and political, personal buddies. And it was certainly not a league for mutual aid and comfort. It included the people who, after that fight, emerged as the central leadership of the movement. And if ever there was a group of people who were the opposite of a clique, if ever there was a combination of people who were diverse and different in their attitudes, their outlook, their personality, their character, their makeup, independent-minded, stubborn, different from one another in many ways, it was this group of Cannonites, what became known as the Cannonites in the party. There was Cannon himself, people like Ray Dunn, Farrell Dobbs, John G. Wright, extremely trained and gifted intellectual, Joe Hansen, Tom Carey, the most stubborn men in the world, George Novak, Murray Weiss, George Clark, Bert Cochran, others. I make the point to indicate that there was this cadre within the party who assumed, finally, the central leadership of the party, and who were and who did consider themselves Cannonites, and yet who had absolutely none of the characteristics of a clique, but the very opposite.
Were there women in that group? Were there women there?
Pardon?
Were there women in that group?
Were there women in that group? I'll answer the question during the question period. What Cannon instilled in the party, and what was best understood by these people who associated themselves with him in this sense, and only in this sense, it did not mean, for example, that they all accepted Cannon's political ideas on each question. Very often, the record will demonstrate, they had political disagreements among themselves and fought very vigorously on a whole series of political questions with a whole series of different lineups on political questions among them. What Cannon instilled in our party at that time, and what was the secret of its survival, was the concept of a leadership team. A team is something that is very different from a clique. It is not based on personal associations, personal likes, personal compatibilities, but is genuinely an inclusive thing. People who are ready to work together, to subordinate personal characteristics and differences between them, to work together as a team, where there are no stars, no individual who is the leader of the team, where the people on the team are capable of recognizing that they have different backgrounds and experiences, tend to make different assessments of political situations on the basis of their different background, experience, and learning, understand that they can and must learn from one another, bolster one another. If you study, for example, the discussion that went on in the party in the late 40s around the developments in Eastern Europe, to my mind, it's not only a very rich political study to read those bulletins, but provides what I think is the model example of how a political discussion is conducted by a political team that is attempting to seek out and work out answers to new and complex questions. And the interchange of ideas that took place and the changes in position from one position to another by different members of the leadership, and how this discussion was carried on in a very serious and objective way, with everyone paying the most careful attention and offering the most serious consideration to the viewpoints presented by the other in the elaboration of an analysis of this very new and very complex phenomenon. One of the principal aspects that Cannon insisted on in the development of a leadership team, and again, you know, there was a point, a reality to this assertion that Cannon was interested only in the organizational question. It's a falsification in one sense, as the political record shows, but there is a reality to it in another sense. That is, Cannon never was and still is not interested in political issues in the abstract. He is interested in the terms that they can be translated into concrete form and to become weapons in the struggle. And to do that means to have organizational conceptions and to be able to translate ideas into practice. And for that reason, Cannon always did pay as much attention to the so-called organizational question as he did to the general theoretical and political questions. And why he wrote so much and taught so much to the party about what a team is, what a leadership is, and how it is necessary to develop a leadership team, that it be an inclusive team, to avoid the error in the developing a leadership for people of seeking out others like themselves, judging that they are effective people, and therefore the way to get a good team, a good branch executive committee, a good state committee, a good national committee, is to assemble as many people as possible who are like them as much as possible. That's a serious mistake, he explained. He says, even if you could do that, which you can't, all you would do is you would get people who have all of the same strengths that you have, but they would also have all of the same weaknesses that you have, and therefore you would necessarily have a one-sided leadership. What you need is people with different abilities, with different strengths, with different weaknesses, and out of that you can consolidate a team which is far more capable of providing answers to this question of understanding what to do and how to do it and when to do it. And all of the experience of our movement has demonstrated that this is what has given our movement its striking power, the capacity to do so much with so little. When you consider, for example, what our movement has done in the anti-war movement, in the building of this enormous anti-war movement, you have to recognize that it is not simply because we had a correct political analysis of the character of the Vietnam War and the needs for organizing a mass independent opposition to that, but that also we had the kind of a leadership and the kind of a team within the movement which is capable of working as a team, of drawing on the experiences and the ability of a whole variety of different kinds of people. For me, one of the most rewarding experiences that I have had in my whole experience in the movement has been in this past period when I have functioned, in addition to being on the paper, within the anti-war movement, and to function on the steering committee of our fraction at various anti-war conferences, and to recognize how in extremely complicated political situations, those of you who have attended these conferences know how fast moving they are, with their bricks flying from every angle, and how you just, you know, have to be watching in 30 different ways at once. And that one of the effectivenesses is not simply our political line, our correct political line, that's basic, but the kind of a staff that we were able to assemble, the different kinds of people with different levels of understanding, with different experiences, with different outlook and inclination. I remember one little example of one conference where the thing worked out just perfect with a balance. Three of us were leading the thing on the floor, a very fast-moving thing. It was Gus Horowitz, Lou Jones, and myself. Well, my tendency in these situations is to be a bit on the conservative side, not to move too quick. Gus's tendency is to try to grab what you can, and if you see a chance to grab a little extra, to grab it.